Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Bonjour, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. I'm on the move. I've run away from home and found my way to Berkeley, California, where I'm currently recording this very special episode. Today's podcast is going to focus exclusively on the 39th Sight and Sound entry, François Truffaut's The 400 Coups, or as it's known in the United States, The 400 Blows. The 400 Blows is a film that deserves all the superlatives and highest honors we can possibly bestow, but what really designates this as an extra special episode are today's very, very, very special guests. First up, I am pleased to announce the return of author, historian, screenwriter, and contributor to the Sight and Sound Critics Poll, Professor Joseph McBride. Welcome back to
the show. Good to be back.
Thank you. I'm so glad we convinced you to come back on.
It's easy to convince me to be on your show.
And now for our next guest. I know there are many filmmakers and cinephiles out there who consider themselves the spiritual descendants of François Truffaut, but there are few who can claim both an intellectual and familial connection. I'm thrilled to announce that the woman completing our panel is none other than François' daughter, Laura Truffaut. Laura, it is an honor to have you on.
It's an honor to be invited. Thank you.
I'm happy to have us all gathered here to talk about your father's first feature film, and I imagine we'll discuss a few of his other works along the way. So now that we're up and running, let's start the show. In 1954, a film critic of some note named François Truffaut wrote a polemic essay for the film journal Cahiers du Cinéma entitled A Certain Trend in French Cinema. In it, he declaims the sorry state of the French movie industry's so-called tradition of quality, lamenting, quote, "It is not exaggerating to say that the 100-odd French films made each year tell the same story." The essay served as a call to action for young, passionate filmmakers to unseat the keepers of the old storytelling guard. The significance of this essay alone might have been enough to cement Truffaut's place in the history books, but for him, continuing to simply decry the work of others wasn't going to suffice. In 1958, he began production on his first feature, The 400 Blows. The film was to be a character study of a young Parisian boy named Antoine Tournel, played by Jean-Pierre Lyode, whose desire for artistic expression and personal autonomy leads to some serious clashes with the authority figures in his life, including his teachers, his parents, and eventually the police. When the film premiered in 1959, it was heralded as a triumph for its unconventional thematic and stylistic elements. It won several prestigious awards, including the Cannes Best Director Trophy, and its popularity has resulted in four sequels, now known as the Cycle of Antoine Tournel. The triumph of the 400 Blows triggered a cinematic revolution. Shortly after its release, a surge of young filmmakers followed Truffaut's example, and a lively, idiosyncratic wave of French films flooded the cinemas in the early 1960s. This so-called New Wave movement changed the way the world viewed not only films, but also low-budget film productions. But what is it specifically about The 400 Blows that sets it apart from the rest of the Nouvelle Vogue? And why does it continue to resonate so strongly with modern audiences? Let us discuss. So, as listeners know, I start off every podcast with the question, do you like this movie? In this instance, it feels a little ridiculous, but nevertheless. So, Laura, do you like The 400 Blows?
I like The 400 Blows a lot. It's perhaps easier now to separate it from watching a story very like my father's childhood story. Mm. I think now I'm a little more able to see it as a movie, as a film.
Mm. Yeah. Joe, how about you?
I've always loved this film because it inspired me. I first saw it in college. I should mention there was a strange thing. I was doing some research on another project, and I looked back at our hometown paper, the Milwaukee Journal, and I found a review of The 400 Blows in 1959 at a theater called the Downer Theater, which is our art theater, which a friend of mine said is the worst name for a theater ever.
They show exclusively Ingmar Bergman.
They show Downers. It's still there. It's still there. But this guy, Don Dooley, who is a friend of ours, wrote a wonderful review. He said, this is a film by this guy, François Truffaut, who's 27 years old, and he's a former film critic who created a thing called The Auteur Theory. And I mean, he had it all nailed, and he understood the film, and he had it perfect. And if I had been reading the paper carefully, I would have gone to see it, but I didn't. So it was college when I saw it, and I was really moved by it, because when somebody makes a personal story that's good, I think we can all relate to it. That's one of the odd things about personal stories, is you see yourself in the character. And I felt a deep affinity for Antoine, and I still did the other day when I watched it again. The old feeling came back, and so it inspired me to make those kind of films. And that's a different story, but it's a great film for many reasons.
Absolutely, yeah. I remember seeing the film and feeling like it was one of the few movies I'd ever seen about childhood that doesn't condescend to the subject.
Mm-hmm.
It treats childhood very seriously, and as most films about childhood, it's often really whimsical. But there's very little whimsy in The 400 Blows, and what is there leads to almost tragedy. Like, he's clearly imaginative and creative, thinking of the shrine to Balzac.
Yeah. Almost burns down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I loved it immediately, and often movies that you see when you're young. I'm sort of skeptical of things that I liked when I was younger, just because I assume I was young and stupid. But in this case, the film really does hold up. And I was reading about François Truffaut's decision, why he wanted to depict childhood in this way. And he said he wanted to do away with the notion that childhood is the good old days.
Mm.
And nostalgia for one's youth is kind of misplaced in a lot of ways. Like, childhood can be difficult.
Yeah, I think that was exactly a central state of mind for him, the sheer joy of being an adult and free.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I've read, you know, every time that I feel depressed, I remember that I'm an adult and I can make decisions for myself, and I instantly feel better.
That's how I felt when I was a kid. I couldn't wait to become an adult and get out of this trap called childhood.
Yeah. So in my intro, I say that it's about Antoine Doinel's desire for autonomy, but in some ways he may want autonomy, but what he needs is structure and compassion, it seems to me.
He needs attention.
Yeah.
And it was important for my father to make that point. It's made, I think, in 400 Blows, maybe in the scene with a psychologist whom we don't see, but we hear her. She engages him in a way that absolutely no other adult in the film does. And then he made that point later more explicitly in, say, The Wild Child and, you know, some other movies, but mostly in The Wild Child, which happens to be dedicated to Jean-Pierre Léaud. The idea that it's not only the absence of love that Antoine Doinel suffers from, but really the absence of attention. There's no room, and there's no bed for him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have a place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I love the film immediately. Joe, you love the film immediately. Laura, you mentioned that your feelings have changed. Can you talk more about that?
I think I saw the film first maybe when I was 12 years old. It was playing somewhere in a repertory theater, and I went to see it. And I was fairly aware it was autobiographical. There was a lot I didn't know. There was some information on my father's life that I really found out while watching the movie, namely that the discovery that his father was not his biological father. I think that somehow had never been said. Mm. I did not know my grandparents. My father had a big falling out with his parents. He wasn't very close to them before, but he, you know, 400 Blows definitely sealed that break. My grandparents actually divorced each other after the movie came out. Mm. And so I grew up not knowing them, and it felt odd, obviously. We were told, well, they don't really like children, and, you know, grandparents who don't like children ran contrary to the image of grandparents, obviously. But my father didn't really develop that any further, and so seeing the film the first time was really entering into that world to a great extent. I think that's really the level at which I saw it first. you know, the films that my father made when I was a child, I was much more aware of the process. Sometimes I would see the dailies. So it was a very different thing. When I would finally see those films once finished, I would see where the dailies fit in and so on. 400 Blows was made while my parents were expecting me. You can see a glimpse of my mother, 7 months pregnant, in one of the last scenes.
And you're in the film.
Indirectly, I am. I take credit. So I think that made a very different experience
absolutely,
for me. Very
yeah.
personal.
I can't imagine going into a theater at 12 years old and discovering all this family history, like this renowned film has all these family secrets.
Yes, I think there were questions. And yet my father was open. He liked to compartmentalize, but I think he liked to let us come up with the questions ourselves. He wasn't secretive in that way. He wasn't painting a different picture from the reality either.
Yeah. Interesting. But have you come to love the film? Or?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I'm better able to take in every performance, for one thing, now, because I've seen it so many times. I really like, for instance, the father a lot. The fact that the mother really never utters her son's name. He's never referred to as who he is. The school, the classroom scenes are probably the furthest away, in a way, from my experience, because school had started to become something less rigid, something less punitive by the time I was in school. And I had a totally different relationship to school than my father had. He was just stunned by that. He couldn't conceive of a child actually enjoying school.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a huge misunderstanding between the two of us.
Yeah.
Did you go to a good school?
I went to a good public school in our neighborhood. It was, we had our share of crazy, perhaps sadistic teachers, like every child in every school, but it wasn't such a punitive world. And I liked the structure of school, which clearly my father was ambivalent about. He would have liked to be a good student. He would have liked his parents to sign him up to further his education. They, out of laziness partly, directed him to a more vocational track. And so he finished school at 14. He finished school at 14 knowing, Balzac paragraphs by heart.
Yeah.
And, so there was really a discrepancy between that world he was supposed to fit in and, his own abilities and aspirations.
He was really an autodidact when I knew him, and he was reading all the time, wasn't he? He loved reading. That's one reason I love Fahrenheit 451, which is his tribute to reading.
Absolutely. At the same time, with the insecurity of an autodidact,
I think.
To me, that's a palpable difference between him and Godard. The relationship to books, which is extremely present for both of them in their work, it's a slightly different thing.
Can you talk more about that?
An autodidact is somebody who is in awe and intimidated by the authority of recognized experts, for instance, in certain fields. So, for instance, another film of my dad's, The Soft Skin, the hero is a professor, expert in Balzac. And we see him travel to a small provincial town along with his mistress. He realizes he can't bring her over to the official dinner before his talk. And then she tries to come and attend the talk. But no, it's sold out. There are fans outside rushing, begging him for autographs. To me, that is really my father's subconscious admiration and, in a way, misunderstanding about the life of an academic.
Yeah, yeah.
This rock star
professor. I don't think Godard would have gone that far.
Did he, I know you have a PhD in comparative literature.
Right.
Did he make a special effort to get you and your sisters well-educated and properly raised compared to the way he
gave us books. He was very happy that we read them. He would engage, we would chat about them, but not more than that. I think he was both happy and totally skeptical watching me go on, in my studies. Because, again, and I think that's an autodidact thing, there's a certain amount of skepticism about those people with all the diplomas, you know. Yeah. So yeah, he was pleased, but he was also utterly puzzled. And my father was somebody who, I mean, I would come home with a good report card. I would call him to let him know. He just didn't know what to say. I mean, really? He was so amazed that it made me happy. That wasn't the way to his heart.
I get the impression that you were treated well compared to the boy in the movie.
Yeah. Oh, very, very, very much so. We were absolutely, my sister and I were both really treated with a lot of love. But my father really was a kid, too. He loved playing. I mean, he couldn't, he couldn't see a baby in a stroller without starting to make faces and play. I mean, he had to engage with children. He really felt a connection with children especially, but with all, really.
I noticed that in Hollywood, he would see a little kid at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and his attention would be riveted, and he would start talking to the kid and on a very direct level,
Joe, how did you know Francois Truffaut?
I met him at Hitchcock's 75th birthday party, oddly enough. right after I joined Daily Variety. I was invited to this party by Hitchcock's publicist, and there was Truffaut sitting in the corner, and he had a hearing problem, so he was a little aloof. He was sitting with his publicist, and I went over and chatted with him, and we bonded pretty quickly because I knew his work really well, and I liked his book on Hitchcock, and, I've always identified with him. He's my favorite modern director. And so I asked him for an interview because it was hard for him to talk in a crowd. I have the same problem with can't filter out background noise. He had that from being in the Army. And so we had an interview, and we got along very well. And so I would see him whenever he came to Hollywood. And I think he came a couple times a year for a vacation.
He, at some point in the 70s, especially after the success of Day for Night, once Day for Night won the Oscar, that just opened doors for him, potential doors, because he didn't actually go through any of those doors. He ultimately was wise enough not to make a movie in America, I think. But he decided to become more fluent in English, so he found a professor, a teacher who he liked, and he would go and spend several weeks of intensive English. And he also felt very close to Jean Renoir and his wife, who you knew, and their home was a haven of French expats, American film fanatics of all ages, and it felt very welcome there. So those were two big draws.
Yeah, he told me he came to Hollywood to do three things: to go to Larry Edmonds' bookshop to buy film books, to sit at the pool at the Beverly Hills Hotel smoking cigars and reading books, and to go to Jean Renoir's house. That was his big thing. But he was, you're right, Hollywood loved him and courted him all the time, but he would never make a film in Hollywood. He told me the closest he came was making Mommy Dearest, which is interesting. He said he was very tempted. He was offered many projects, but he said he turned it down because two things. One, they wanted Anne Bancroft to play the part, and he admired her, but he thought that one star cannot play another star. Yeah. Convincingly, and also he felt his English was not good enough. He always felt insecure with English, even though he spoke pretty good English. But he just, and part of it, maybe he was worried about being sucked into the Hollywood trap.
That too, I think fundamentally, working on Fahrenheit 451, which was shot in English and in England, taught him to be wary of that. He had a habit of writing dialogues progressively as the shooting went on, hearing how his actors expressed themselves. And that was especially true with children. I mean, Small Change did not have, had barely any dialogue written, but the situations were written. The gist of the dialogue was written. Mm. But it was also true for his other films. And I think it started with 400 Blows, wanting to see how Jean-Pierre Léo and the other teenager expressed themselves. And so then he would, for all his movies, really write the dialogue or rewrite the dialogue progressively, a couple of days before, as late as possible for him, but his actors often insisted on having the dialogue a little earlier. You see that in Day for Night, and it's a very accurate depiction of how he worked. He felt with English he would not have been able to have that sense of what would feel natural for a character and what wouldn't. He would have to rely on an assistant, on somebody who would have the same concerns as he did, because he also did not want slang necessarily, or he was very particular, and that's something he really could not control in English. I think that was really a big concern that he had all along. And then there was also the very rigid hierarchical system of a Hollywood film crew, which he suspected because he read a lot. He read a lot of books. I can't remember the title. The book about the shooting of Heaven's Gate was something that
Stephen Bach's book. Yeah,
he loved that book. Yeah. Pretty much memorized it, you know. And then working as an actor on Close Encounters of the Third Kind gave him that opportunity to be part of this, but as an actor. And he was, you know, his impressions were confirmed by the film. You know, if you were not on this part of the crew, and I don't know, a plug needed to be replugged, some of the cable needed to be lifted, you weren't supposed to touch it. I mean, he worked, you know, French filmmaking in his case especially, but I think it was generally true at the time because of more modest budgets, there was much more flexibility involved, and he liked working with the same crew. There was it's a little corny to speak of a sense of family, but there was some of that. And he, I think, had the sense that, you know, a Hollywood film, even with a relatively modest budget, would be just more rigid, more foreign to him, really.
Right. You were on Small Change. You worked on Small Change.
Right.
And you're in Small Change, too. How's it, what's it like to be directed by your father?
Well, first, you find out the day before the shoot that you are playing this role, which was meant for somebody else who had a dental emergency.
Oh, really?
And it happens to be, suddenly somebody not your father says, remember, you have to show up at 8 a.m. tomorrow for makeup because... And I said, why? I'm, doing script supervising. Why do I need makeup? Oh, because you play the scene where you're going to be tumbling in the bushes with the American GIs. So my father was very good at avoiding awkward conversations, and that was one of many he avoided. I was very lucky because my partner in those scenes was the assistant cameraman. And so he really always moved me around to be in the most flattering position. Oh, I was really very well handled. No professional actor would ever have done that.
Yeah. That's nice. Well, you had a little movie within the movie is about you. It's kind three, 4 minute Truffaut movie. It's done as a newsreel where you play the mother of a child who's a whistler who can't talk because he has a French mother and an English father. It's kind of a comical variation on his theme of communication, which is a big deal in Wild Child and other films.
Yes. Also pre-signed because I ended up marrying an American and having that issue brought up in my own home. But my name in that little movie, I don't know if you noticed, was Madeleine, which is my mother's first name, and Douanel.
I'm Madame Douanel.
Well, Small Change has a lot of parallels between it and 400 Blows. I mean, it's also kind of emblematic of the evolution of his depiction of childhood. Can you talk more about
that? Exactly. And his depiction of teachers especially.
Yeah.
I think he wanted to, partly because of his daughter's radically different experience of school, he wanted to modify the impression. Well, you know, to get back to 400 Blows, it started as a project that would have encompassed several stories with different children of different ages and different perspectives on childhood, not all dark. Progressively, in the writing of the screenplay, it became all about Antoine. First, it was called Antoine Runs Away, but that was going to be only one story among many. Some of those other stories find themselves in Small Change. The little girl who manages to get locked alone in the apartment, that's a story that happened to my mother when she was 3 or 4. My father always knew he wanted to have it in a movie. So some stories, such as this one and others, some grave, some lighter, some comedy, some darker, were discarded, and some were totally discarded. Some reappeared at the time of Small Change. And I think... you know, in Small Change, you can see that's how the movie is made. I mean, that you know, that texture of the movie is perhaps, you know, fairly apparent. There was, I think, an attempt to show the teachers in a more nuanced way. And then in the speech, there is one abused child we know in the movie, or neglect a child. And we don't know through the film, but we get a sense there's something wrong with him. And then we find out, but we find out through the attentiveness of adults, which was sorely lacking in 400 Blows. Mm-hmm. And then the teacher towards the end has a speech in which he makes parallels between, he draws a parallel between his own story and the story of that child, and refers to the lack of freedom ultimately that children have upon their own lives, and how adult life in a way is a revenge on that. To backtrack a little bit, I think it's worth noting that 400 Blows, even though it takes place nominally in 58-59 when it was made, in truth took place for my father during the war in 42-43, and there's not, I mean, the film, it's hard to date the film when you see it, to say, when is that story taking place? There's a little bit of a ambiguity there. So what he's showing us is also the school world of the 40s, of the occupation, more importantly. He could not really afford making a period movie. There were a lot of stories about his perception of French occupation as a child that he would have liked to convey. I think the scene where the kid who's, you know, the teacher's pet, shows up at the parents' apartment and says, "Oh, I'm coming to see Antoine. Is he sick?" And that's a little bit an allusion to that era, which was full of denunciation, anonymous letters, and that climate was something he wanted to convey, you know, as best he could. But there is, 400 Blows is in between. It's obviously not a period movie, but there is some vagueness. The people standing in line at the bakery or the grocery, you know, certain elements.
One thing I liked about the film a lot this time, I've always liked it, I think, because I remember these scenes so well, is the documentary quality. That he mentioned in an interview I saw that he was going for kind of a documentary feeling, and he compared it to Germany Year Zero, the Rossellini film, which was made right after World War II. In the ruins of Berlin, and it's very stark and very graphic, and it's about a boy who kills himself, and it's a really bleak film. But there's this amazing contrast in 400 Blows between the family scenes, which are very cramped and claustrophobic, and that makes a certain social point without preaching that these people are lower middle class. You know, part of their problem is they live so close together and they're crawling all over each other, and there's a lot of tension. And then there's this explosion of when the kids go out on the street and run around, and there's this freedom, even though they're still trapped in childhood, they're running around Paris on the loose, which is wonderful. These great widescreen shots. And I love the idea that he said he shot the film in widescreen to counteract the squalor of the subject, to give the people a feeling of spectacle and happiness. But it does give a sense of contrast between the two halves of the film.
And he felt that that freedom of being outside was, I think, linked to the experience of being a child during the occupation. When you, if you were not Jewish, if you didn't have to hide. Which was my mother's story. For my father, the war was, he felt, Paris at night was a little bit of a playground, in the sense that because of bomb alerts, subway stations remained open all through the night. Mm-hmm. And so you'd hear a bomb alert routinely, and everybody in the whole neighborhood would go down to the subway station, and kids would play there. There was no train running, so you could walk on the tracks from one station to the next. I think it felt dark too. You know, obviously it was very dark, no light outside. And my father lived, as Antoine Doinel does, in a neighborhood that's a shady neighborhood. But he had the sense, I think, that the city, you know, belonged to him at night.
As Falstaff says in Chimes of Midnight, the laws of England are at my commandment. Did he, I know he dealt with the occupation very well in The Last Metro. Did he want to make a film later about a child during the occupation?
Yes, it would have been, he wrote the screenplay for that, co-wrote it with Claude de Givray, who co-wrote some of the Doinel movies. It was called The Little Thief. It was transposed, though. It was a young woman, you know, with no parents that we know of leading a slight life of crime. And the film, the screenplay, was made later by Claude Miller. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting film. It does take place right after the war. Mm-hmm. So it has all those elements that my father was very keen on filming one day. The star is Charlotte Gainsbourg, and I think it's a little softer, more... It's hard to know, you know, it's hard to know what he would have made. I think he was trying for something harsher, but he did not really... It was something between a synopsis and a full screenplay. It wasn't a full-fledged screenplay.
Right. And, what about the harsh depiction of the parents in 400 Blows? I think it's very honest. That's the kid's perspective, and it caused him some problems with his own parents at the time, and but I find I respond very powerfully to that, the isolation of the child and the feeling of being unloved in the film.
But then there are those spurts of tenderness, or I'm not sure what the right word is, which, and I think that's very true to life too, that somebody who's distant and cold is not going to be distant and cold every minute of every day. You know, we don't know what to make of his mother's sudden tenderness. I mean, she clearly she's felt guilty.
That's a wonderful scene where they go out to a movie, and it's just so joyous when you see him laughing with his parents in the car with the lights inside the car. It's beautiful. And
it was one of the scenes he was proudest of for the movie. And what he called a break in tone, which was very important to him. It always occurs in his movies. There's something goes counter to your expectations or the tone, really, the tenor of the scene shifts, and that's something he was always very interested in.
There's so many funny moments in the film. Certainly the kids in the school, even though the teacher is an ogre, but the kids are mischievous and raucous, and he and his friend, based on his own childhood friend Robert Lachenay, there's some wonderful moments with them. And the scene with the puppet theater, I love. It's so Truffaut. The wonderful shots just filling the screen of kids just... Documentary shots of kids having a wonderful time.
I think he had half an hour of it, and it was hard for him to cut. And I guess the camera was right next to the stage, because the children are absolutely not looking at the camera. Mm-hmm. They're totally oblivious. And to me, it makes the point that they're still kids. They're teenagers. They're not at the stage in life where those much younger kids are. But it's still childhood. You know, there's still a connection. They're still wandering the Luxembourg Garden and... I like that. Jean-Pierre Léaud brought some levity to the film. It would have been darker with a different actor. Apparently, my father felt that one of his main duties during the shooting was to remind Jean-Pierre not to smile.
Oh, yeah.
Don't smile.
Yeah.
But whether he smiles or not, there's something so fetching. His gutsy and his gutsiness is funny and sweet. And my father saw that as a big departure from himself. I mean, when he cast him, he had no doubt he wanted to cast him. But he also measured the difference between how he had been as a child, or how he perceived himself to have been, more sneaky, more, you know, not making waves, just being as invisible as possible. And that's not Antoine as played by Jean-Pierre Léaud. There's something so, you know, so much spunk.
In the sequels, some have suggested that the levity in those films, it might be the influence of Léaud having greater impact or input in the storytelling. Yeah. Is that true?
That's possible. Yeah. That's possible. I don't know, because each time my father was surprised that the film was always a little darker than he had anticipated. He always felt halfway through the shooting that things were developing not totally the way he had assumed at first. And so that's probably true. And then there's this issue of, you know, Antoine Doinel becoming an adult. What does he do of his life? How does an autobiographical character or, you know, fairly autobiographical, you know, how does he evolve? Antoine Doinel is so drawn to a certain element of fantasy in his life.
He becomes more different from Francois than he was in the first film.
Yeah,
and then it really has to stop. It has to stop because there's no
There's a great quote from Renoir that I've always told my screenwriting students. He said, you should always change the script to fit the actor instead of changing the actor to fit the script.
Yeah. I think my father quotes that too. It was something he was aware of. He believed in that too.
But there's something wonderful. I was reading his notes about Leo from the audition, and he was taken with him right away. He said he was very beautiful. And he also said there's a feminine quality to him, which is interesting. That doesn't quite come across in 400 Blows, except, the sensitivity, which is traditional at the time, female value. But he became maybe more androgynous in later films, I don't know.
I'm not even sure that we see it, but my father perceived it that way, and that would apply to a number of his actors. I think that would apply to Oscar Werner in Jules and Jim easily. Mm, that would apply to Charles Denner in his segment in The Bride Wore Black and in maybe in The Man Who Loved Women too. I mean, he was Gérard Depardieu in The Woman Next Door. There was something that my father seeked in a male protagonist.
He told me he liked actors who were not macho. He said, I said, which American actors do you like? He said, I like Sam Waterston because he is not macho.
That was after we saw The Great Gatsby. That was a revelation. To me, when I saw it, I thought, that man is so much like Jean-Pierre Léaud. The first
Sam Waterston.
Who I saw first in The Great Gatsby, I remember when he came out. And I thought, oh, there's an American Jean-Pierre Léaud.
I put that in the paper hoping that they would work together. Another thing your father said that was very interesting to me, he said, I think it's more instructive to compare actors to actors of different genders. And he said an example is Isabelle Adjani and 400 in Adele H reminds me of Charles Laughton.
Yeah.
I said, Charles Laughton. He said, well, she's got this obstinate lower lip and she's very obstinate and she's very unusual. And he said, don't compare them to other actresses or whatever. And so maybe comparing a guy to a woman is a good idea too.
He also famously said, Catherine Deneuve is the man I would have liked to be.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting quote. I didn't know that. Well, Leo is... one of the scenes, there's so many great scenes, but the scene with the psychiatrist is just wonderful. And he seems, that's like a documentary scene. I know it was sort of improvised, but it has this unvarnished quality of a young boy talking.
Yeah, I think Jean-Pierre Léaud got some of the questions ahead of time that were going to be thrown at him, probably not all. It's the only scene that was filmed with direct sound. Mm. And it was a very intimate scene, so only my father and Henri Dequet, the cinematographer, and Jean-Pierre were there in the room. And there was always the intention of then having the voice dubbed by a woman. That woman is named Annette Vadmans. She's a screenwriter. And my father knew he wanted her, and at some point he realized it was better without any, counter shots of her face for a number of reasons. One reason was that she was very pregnant during that scene, and in a very Hitchcockian way, my father thought, well, if the audience sees the psychologist and she's pregnant, their mind is going to wander in another direction. They're going they're going to see her too obviously as a mother figure. And he didn't want that. One reason he admired Hitchcock so much is he felt Hitchcock was so aware of the audience and of where of ways not to squander the audience's attention. So all this conspired to I think make the scene really really. Good.
Right. Although I see it as a kind of counteraction to his mother. There's this shocking scene where his mother comes to the hospital and just tells him, we're just dropping you. Goodbye. So at least there's a sympathetic female voice.
Right. Right.
Which I think is part of his method, too, of kind of complicating your response. And the mother is so strongly harsh. I read that he had some trouble with the actress who wanted to. She worried that she was coming off as too harsh, too.
Right. It's very hard for an actor to play that kind of a role and not to deviate, I think. I do think she's very good.
She is very good, and she's very real. I mean,
in Love on the Run, the final installment of the Antoine Doinel cycle, he has a character make a comment about how you shouldn't work out your personal vendettas in your work. Did your father ever come to regret the depiction of his parents?
That scene is also in Bed and Board. I think it's more full in Bed and Board. I think fundamentally no. Mm. I think he may have said so, but no. I think fundamentally no. In fact, he felt he was restraining himself. His father was still alive when my father died, and he was by then very careful about not making him any more sad, but he would have returned to the subject. He would have made, I think, a more personal and, you know, quite possibly harsher film. It was something that he hadn't expected the film to be so successful. He had thought he was making a small art movie that would be seen by some people, and suddenly it was on magazine covers and was a big deal at the time. And so his parents were even told by friends and relatives, don't go see it, it'll upset you, that ingrate François did you a terrible disservice. So he never regretted doing it, but he had not expected that it would affect them to this extent.
How did you feel about your career? Was he trying to get you to? I mean, he gave you opportunities to be in the film business, but you didn't want to do that ultimately, did you?
Well, I was divided. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, I loved school. I was very clear that I wanted to be a high school teacher to teach literature, to teach French. But when I saw Day for Night, where the character of Jean-Pierre Léaud's girlfriend, played by Dany, is there simply to... She's been hired as a assistant script supervisor just so she can be there on the set with her boyfriend. Well, that gave me an idea. And this was the summer I was 16, the summer where... I was legally allowed to have a paying job, and all my friends were applying to be, cashiers at the supermarket. And I thought, well, this is a movie that's being filmed during my summer vacation. I'm free. To be free. So about a year before, I brought it up, and my father was cornered. So he said yes. It was a wonderful experience. It was incredibly hard to go back to high school after that. I still had 1 year of high school to finish. And really, to go back in the middle of, 17-year-old girls after such an incredible experience was very hard. But he didn't want to influence me too much. And then I went on to college, and then he was filming The Man Who Loved Women in Montpellier, a few hours away from Paris. And I took advantage of a school break to go on that set and try to make myself useful, because I remembered what the script supervisor does. So it was the same crew, more or less, with the addition of Nestor Almendros at the camera, who was just, I don't know if you happen to know him, but he was a wonderful, wonderful man. I got along so well with that crew. It was also finally a chance to see professional actors at work, because on Small Change, we only had... really, at the time, one, maybe two professional actors. One of the teachers, Jean-François Stevenin, became an actor afterwards. He's a very successful actor-director now. Mm-hmm. And the mother, the woman who owns the hair salon, mm-hmm. was a theater mm-hmm. actress. Mm-hmm. Nobody else in that mm-hmm. one film was mm-hmm. an actor. To see what goes on between, between action and cut... with professional actors was so fantastic. It was very, very hard to pull myself away from that. And I debated for a while, what do I do? And, decided for now to stay in college. And then I went on. I never regretted it, really. It was wonderful, but I also was told by enough people in the crew that not all shoots were like that, not all movies were like that. Mm-hmm. I was really torn, but I think what I inherited from my father was that pedagogical strain, and so that's what I went on with.
When I met you, you were with your father, you and your sister, when you were about 17, I guess.
Right, or 18, yeah.
You struck me as being very studious and very intellectual even then, I could tell. And so I kind of thought you would wind up in academic career.
You were right.
Yeah.
kind of. With detours. But it's a wonderful experience. I mean, a film set this is really so intense and so colorful. It's, you know, it's life improved 200%. I think directors have, depending on their temperaments, have different feelings regarding different steps of their work. Some directors may feel more fully directing when they're at the editing process or planning the film, perhaps. Or, you know, my father was not somebody who did storyboarding very, very rarely. His screenplays, as I mentioned, were really not very rigid. Sometimes drastic changes happened during the shooting. But I really got the sense that the shoot, those few weeks, were really the time where he lived at the fullest. I mean, ultimately, that's why I asked him for the job. I wanted to see what it was like, what he was like, doing what mattered to him the most. And I think I was very lucky to get to see that, and especially on Small Change, which was, by and large, an easy process. There was no crisis. There was no, you know.
Seems like a joyous film.
Yeah. Fairly, yeah, yeah.
The first film, we didn't talk about Andre Bazin, who was his mentor and kind of father figure, and he died the day your father started shooting 400 Blows. Yeah. That must have been quite a strange experience.
I think that must have been very painful, because certainly he was the person to whom my father was most eager to show to show his film to. He was truly his father figure. Later, probably Renoir was. But Bazin, he lived with Bazin, his wife. Bazin vouched for him at really crucial times in his life, enabled him to get out of a life of petty crime.
Yeah. And the film is dedicated to him.
Right.
Okay, he made him who he was and helped him find who he was.
Yeah.
So there's a symmetry to that.
Yeah.
But it's sad.
But it's a sad
It's sad. It may have colored the making of the film and made it sad.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Let me ask you another question. One of the things, there's kind of a, well, I don't know what there is now, but for a long time there was a Truffaut camp and a Godard camp, and you could only be in one or the other.
I think there still is, you know, Beatles on the Stones.
Yeah, I was in the Truffaut camp. But one of the raps against your father was that he was too bourgeois, that his films became bourgeois. I didn't mind that because I saw the deeper reason for that, which is that he started out with a very rough life and life on the streets, and to him, having a family and having a comfortable bourgeois life was something to attain, something to look forward to, and it was hard won. And I felt the poignancy of that in his work.
Yeah. I agree. I think you can only, in order to reject bourgeois life, you have to have enjoyed it in the first place. And really, he had no space, no place to be rejecting something like that.
Whereas Godard came from a comfortable life, and he could afford to be rebellious about it.
Well, I think for two things. First, at a personal level, and that lasted through his life, my father really saw himself as a little bit of an outsider. I mean, he was extremely touched by recognition awards, mostly by the fact that a successful movie would enable him to make the next film. That really was his main focus in life. He was his own producer. Godard had, you know, many producers, some films with much higher budgets. You know, Godard worked with Brigitte Bardot and Michel Piccoli, my father didn't. But I mean, to go back to this issue of bourgeois and not bourgeois, I don't know how interesting it is. You know, my father, to his last days, could not bring himself to vote. He didn't feel really entitled. He had spent time in prison, you know, twice really. And deep down, he did feel as a little bit outside. I wouldn't push that too far. He did have a comfortable life and, you know, was able to spend those nice weeks in Los Angeles in comfort and... Really, his focus, the way he would define freedom was the ability to make the next film. Sometimes it meant giving up on something that would be too expensive or unattainable. Every movie he made was a movie he wanted to make. He was never commissioned to do something. That's an enormous amount of freedom. It's rare. So he worked, what he did with pretty much no strings attached. Because how else do you make The Wild Child? I mean, you know, how else do you make The Green Room? But he was extremely aware of balancing the choices. So, you know, he wasn't going to make two movies about death and honoring the dead in a row. That would not have enabled him to make a third movie.
Can you talk about how your father discovered his love of film?
Well, I think it started again during the war when he started skipping school Well, first, if you start skipping school, you have to have a place to go. He had started going to movies before. As a young child, he had a very vivid memory of seeing one particular movie by Abel Gance called Lost Paradise, a beautiful melodrama. And this was right when France was drafted into the war, and people were very emotional in the movie theater. And seeing all that emotion really drew him in. And he spent the war sometimes skipping school, and there were in Paris a few movie theaters that opened at 10 a.m. So he would go and ditch his, you know, his satchel, just like in the movie, early on, just to not be too noticed. And apparently those movie theaters were full of kids skipping school. And so because they would show movie, you know, on a permanent basis nonstop, so you would see the same film all day if that's where you had to stay, you know, away from the cold. And so the experience of films became very quickly the experience of seeing the same movie again and again, maybe five times in the same day. And that to him was crucial. That was something he really believed in. He really believed in seeing something many times. But I think he was also tempted by literature. He read voraciously and came from a family that read voraciously. His grandmother, his mother's mother, who had lived with him, had taken care of him until her death when he was about eight, had passed on that love of reading. And he probably thought also about writing books. And then when he saw Citizen Kane after the war, once American movies could finally come to France, then he felt, oh, that's a profession, that's a job, and I could do that. All the films he had seen before, it wasn't always clear to him that there is a profession and it's called director and you're the author of the movie. That's why he placed Citizen Kane so high on his pantheon. For him, it was the film that had inspired the greatest number of vocations. You can choose to tell the story in whatever order you choose. You can have, you know, several narrators and one can be unreliable or, you know, it felt doable, I think. That so from then on, he knew he wanted to become a director, and he memorized the names of every director of every film he saw.
And talk about the role that André Bazin played in his development as a cinephile and then eventually a director.
Well, you know, I'll do my best. I didn't know André Bazin. André Bazin found him, heard him discuss movies at various clubs where there would be debates, and he was struck by, I guess, how argumentative my father could be. My father, at age 16, with a friend, decided to create his own club, and they found a theater, and they convinced various people to trust them. And the screenings were going to take place on the same day of the week as André Bazin's own club. So he went to André Bazin to convince him to change the date just to not be in full competition, which was incredibly arrogant. But André Bazin agreed. And that's really how they started knowing each other and paying attention to each other. After my father's first time in the detention center that you see in 400 Blows, Bazin vouched for him, helped find him a job in a nonprofit that focused on popular culture, and I guess he was in charge of cinema there. And I'm not exactly sure what the job consisted of, but he did this for a while, and then when André Bazin got involved in the beginnings of Cahiers du Cinéma, my father started writing and working there. And that's probably where he started finding his own footing, because on some authors, on some filmmakers, they did not see eye to eye. Bazin really liked William Wyler. For my father and the friends of his generation, Rivette, Godard, no, William Wyler was not an author. There was the critic and later director Alexandre Astruc, too, who was a little older, who developed the author theory, or the what it was called the camera pen, the camera stylo. I'm not, you know, I wish I knew better what movies did. I think it's Bazin who introduced my father to Rossellini. I'm not 100% sure. I think so. And he ended up working for Rossellini for helping him write a couple of screenplays that were never made. And that took him in maybe various directions.
Well, I think we all in America emulated your father because he and Rivette and Romer, they would go and interview these directors who they loved, and I tried to do that. Every director I loved, I tried to get to know. And then you learn from them because there weren't film schools where you could learn from professors. You had to learn from the practitioners. But we were fortunate they were all around at the time.
Right.
And generous with their time.
You know. Right. Well, they weren't... The cult of the director didn't quite exist yet. No. So it's not like people were knocking on doors to interview them.
They were lonely and they were so thrilled when some young guy came and knew their work.
Yes, you know? I think there's that. And there was a hierarchy in the French studio system, such as it was the way there was and probably still is in Hollywood, which is there's a second assistant and maybe you move to first assistant. And then in France, you then would become a director. I mean, normally my father should not have been able to make 400 Blows. The state has a little bit of control in that because in France, the state subsidizes every film to some degree or another. And so he got around that by hiring Philippe de Broca as first assistant. And Philippe de Broca was not a director yet, but became a director 1 or 2 years later, a very successful one. Or maybe he was the technical advisor. The system was not totally a free-for-all in France, in contrast to America, but it was a little bit more flexible at that time, during that moment where so many of them, Rivette, Chabrol, Godard, were able to...
It's also inspiring to see these films today, because I think we're going back to that period. You know, as I say, I think the big-budget blockbusters have kind of ruined Hollywood, and the only solution is to go back and shoot on the streets with these gritty personal films, low budget, and make what you want to make. And so I think it's, you know, the cycle has come back to 400 Blows and those other films that they were making.
Yeah, I was very touched when I saw Frances Ha a couple of years ago, which had a very sweet nod to 400 Blows. They Baumbach used the score at some point, and you can tell his love of movies in every shot, that movie.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the great young filmmakers do love old movies. Yeah. And as Peter Bogdanovich said recently, it's the only medium in which we say old movies. We don't say old symphonies. Right. Let's see an old
theater.
Let's hear an old symphony. Let's read an old novel. Old movie. But 400 Blows doesn't seem like an old movie. Although I like the sense of place and time, and that's part of the documentary quality, that you feel you're back in Paris in the late 50s and things were changing. And
But it's very incidental. And in fact, my father, this is not something he was necessarily happy with. I mean, he liked his films to not have any trendy element, be it in the clothing. I mean, to me, the costumes in, say, The Man Who Loved Women are kind of atrocious, but at least they're not of their period. I kind of understand it now. At the time, I thought, how did those actresses agree? I mean, Leslie Caron has a very moving scene, scene at the heart of the movie, but she's wearing a feather boa nobody in their right mind would be wearing in the middle of the day. And
it makes you seem like an actress, which she is.
It's totally my father's notion of, I don't know, but now I understand by being indifferent, or even... That's not even indifferent.
Out of touch.
It's more willful than that. I think it was intentional. Coco Chanel said, "Fashion is what falls out of fashion," and I think my father felt that way about some elements of film. So of course, 50, 60 years later, there is that documentary element that we feel in so many movies, actually, that we see, that's how the subway was, or, watch, Pickpocket, whatever, that's how streets were, they were really dark.
That's part of the appeal of movies to me, is that they're time machines, actually. I like that quality. Orson Welles said that if an artist should always be out of step with his times.
Yeah.
He was defiant, like
absolutely.
Your father.
I think that my father would absolutely agree. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, I guess because you're making a low-budget film, you have no option but to shoot in the streets. But I don't mind that. I love the documentary quality. But it's also a story, and it's very well constructed, and it's well acted. And, it's got everything in it for a personal film that's also very entertaining. It's also very amusing and funny. He always felt the need to entertain people.
Yes.
And give some jokes and some lightening to the dark qualities of the film.
The audience was always, front and center in his mind. How do we keep them interested? Here they are, hostages in a movie theater for an hour and a half or 2 hours in the dark. Mm. It's not like television. They can't switch the channel. They can't walk away. We hope.
They paid their money.
And And what, you know, so thinking about it, not necessarily in act, but he thought very much in reel, in the first reel, in the second reel, he really thought about that.
Well, like in the school scene, the little kid who, Richard Kanayan, who starts messing up his school book, and there's a long take, and it didn't have to be in the film, but it's wonderful because it lightens the tone of this oppressive thing where this kid is. But it also fits the theme of the film. I have this theory that every shot in a film should be the film in miniature, about the theme. Yeah. Otherwise, it shouldn't be in the film. But that's about rebellion, like inability to do his lessons the way he's supposed to do it.
But I think it also brings memories to everybody. We all remember those moments in school. Even when you want to do well, I mean, I had atrocious penmanship, and I was still, when I was a child in Paris in the 60s, we still had an inkwell, and we were still using those notebooks and those pens, and they would hold me after class sometimes. And my fingers would always be covered in ink. And there's the goodwill of those kids. School is a place where of power and oppression one way or another, even if it's...
Well, you know, it also reminded me of in the Truffaut-Hitchcock book, he mentions in Sabotage, the wonderful Hitchcock film, there's a little boy who's very good. And he said there's a scene that he liked where he makes a mess and then he hides it so his mother won't catch him. And he said that captures a lot about childhood, and Hitchcock really understood that children make messes and hide them. And there's a lot of that in 400
Blows. He's always trying. Apparently the scene where he wipes his fingers on the curtains, I think that's from a Charlie Chaplin movie. But
but we've all done that.
There's goodwill. By and large, he's not a rebel.
They're not horrible kids.
He's a rebel by default. And I think this notion, too, of misunderstanding, or one small error leads to a graver one, leads to the biggest lie, leads to, you know.
Yeah.
He said to me when I asked him the difference between 400 Blows and Small Change, he says he was more forgiving toward the parents in Small Change. And I said, maybe that's because you'd become a parent. And, you know, I personally felt this, that, you know, when I became a parent, I suddenly realized, oh, my parents aren't as bad as I thought they were, because the errors I was making were the same errors.
I don't think my father had any such thought when he became a parent.
When
he became a parent, he thought, great. I'm going to have fun with my kids.
Call
them by their names.
Yeah, and not do what my parents did to me. But there is this kind of benign, forgiving quality, and the adults are more understandable and sympathetic in Small Change. But on the other hand, there's something very truthful about the harshness and indifference of the parents in 400 Blows, which I respond to very much.
Yeah. So I think it's about time to start wrapping this up. For final question... What is your favorite François Truffaut film? Do you have one?
I'm asked that often, so I'm always prepared. And it rotates, you know. It rotates these days. I usually function with three, if I may. I would say Stolen Kisses.
Okay.
Shoot the Piano Player and The Wild Child right now.
All right. I love Shoot the Piano Player. It feels like a gangster film made by someone who's deeply ambivalent about... gangster films.
Absolutely. You nailed it.
It's a great one. Joe, do you have a favorite?
I go back to 400 Blows. I think when I did my Sight and Sound poll, they asked me for my 10 favorite films. And you know, you can't pick the 10 greatest films. There is no such thing.
Yeah.
So I just thought, who are my 10 favorite directors? And I'll pick one by each one. And that was hard because, you know, when you love a director, I love all Truffaut films and I love all Renoir films, et cetera, you know, so I had to pick one. So I picked the one that meant the most to me personally. And 400 Blows means an awful lot to me in my life. It inspired me and freed me and taught me what films could be, personal expression and letting your guts out. Tennessee Williams said an artist should never be embarrassed. And I took that to heart, too. And I think Truffaut taught us that, too, that, you know, here is my life and take it or leave it. And we all took it because we could relate to it. Mm-hmm. But I love, you know, I love all his films. The Man Who Loved Women is a film that means a lot to me today. He said that he wanted to make a film about the writing of a book and the production of a book, among other things. It's also all about women. And, you know, there's so many great things. The Wild Child is a great film about education. Yeah. So those three films do stand out.
Yeah, I have to say, I think 400 Blows still tops my list. The soft spot for the soft skin.
Oh, yes. That is a fantastic film. That's the kind of film that grows when, you know, I saw it again. I thought, oh, my God, this is a great film. And sometimes you have to age into a film to understand it.
I think that was the case for me with 400, with Two English Girls, rather.
Right.
I mean, seeing Two English Girls when I was 15, 16, really, or 20 for that matter, or 25, did not resonate. When I was 40, because it's really a movie about that. It's a movie about your young years from the perspective of of being 40 and wasted opportunities and
Exactly.
Plenty to choose from. You really can't go wrong. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. What is your favorite Francois Truffaut film? Come let us know in our comments section on our website, flixwise.com. You can leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flixwise. You can follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. But before you do all of that, please rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. Help us stand out in the database. The next Sight and Sound entry is Federico Fellini's La Dolce Vita. So we'll have that coming soon. We may also have a FlixWise favorites entry. Check Twitter and Facebook for updates. Until then, Laura, it has been an absolute honor. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It was a treat. Thank you.
And Joe, Professor, thanks for talking with me.
Well, it's always wonderful to be on your show, and a special treat to be with Laura on this particular program.
Such a privilege.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I don't think there's such a thing as a freeze frame in podcasting, but here's to an abrupt, ambiguous ending.